Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is Lamorna Ashe, one of Britain's brightest up-and-coming non-fiction writers. Having read English at Oxford and then an MA in social anthropology at UCL, Ashe decided to move to Newlyn in Cornwall to learn about the fishing community there. Her experiences are detailed in her debut book, Dark, Salt, Clear, Life in a Cornish Fishing Town, which is shortlisted for the Wainwright Prize. Lamorna, welcome to the show. I mentioned your education in the intro because it was an academic project that led you to research for your book. Tell me how that came about.
So to begin with, I had no intention of writing a book. For your master's in anthropology, you need to go and do a fieldwork for a month somewhere. And I had to decide where I wanted to go. And I had all these grand plans of kind of, because I'd read so much extraordinary anthropology that year and I wanted to go maybe abroad. And then as I kept thinking about it, I realized that not speaking another language was going to be such a barrier for me, because it's that thing of asking someone else to translate their life back into English for you. So I thought, okay, no, better to go closer to home. And what I really like in anthropology is there's sort of this subjective turn at the moment where it's, what does that place mean to you? Why are you drawn to that place? And I thought, well, my mum is from Cornwall. Why don't I go back to Cornwall? And I know that the fishing community is so important there, but I've only ever really seen it as a tourist picking up fish from the local fishmongers. So I went to Cornwall for a month, and it was the way I wrote my dissertation. I think it's that slightly sort of 21, 22 year old anxiety of using these big jargon words from anthropology. And it meant that the whole thing felt quite dense. And then I was writing an article about my experiences on the trawler that I'd spent a week on for the Times Literary Supplement. And it felt a relief to suddenly write in this more natural, hopefully fluid way. And I was just, it just so happened that my book then got picked up by a publisher. And he said, okay, you have to lose all the anthropology and then turn this into an actual book.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for those of us who are not familiar with Cornish fishing communities, one gets the impression that they're very tightly knit, possibly a little misogynist, and that an outsider would not be welcome, particularly on a boat, because aren't women bad luck at sea?
Yeah, notoriously bad luck at sea. I got told that so many times before I went. My anthropology supervisor said, almost not worth mentioning in your kind of proposal of what you're going to do, that you'll go on a boat because no one ever gets to go on a boat. But I kind of went with that. I don't know if it was sort of naivety, but I was kind of like, oh, I think I could go on a boat. Well, hopefully that will happen. But what was so incredibly lucky, and I'm so thankful for, and the people that the book is dedicated to, is I had found a couple who had a spare room in Newlyn, this couple called Denise and Lofty, and they very kindly let me stay with them. And they were right at the centre of the community. Denise was a fishmonger, and Lofty worked at Savitech, which is where they sell all the lifeboats and ropes and that kind of thing. So they knew everyone at the pub. And we got on so well that they'd kind of just, at the pub, Denise would go around sort of with me in her arm and say, hello, this is Lamorna. Can you take her out on a boat? And if you do anything to her, then you have to answer to me. So I just got this incredible entrance. And it meant that I got to go on, like, I don't know how many different kinds of boats, 7, 8 kinds of boats, really.
And there was one in particular, Philadelphia, that most of your experience is based around. Tell me about life on that trawler and how it differed.
Sure. So I think I'm the kind of person, I don't tend to look before I leap. And so as soon as Don said, okay, you can come on the trawler, I thought, okay, great, that's a brilliant experience, this is going to be wonderful. So he told me about a week before, he was like, yeah, sure, just come, just bring a sleeping bag and some wellies and you'll be fine. So I had this kind of small bag of stuff and got on to this. I'd been on another trawler before, but it was a very new sleek boat which had Wi-Fi and kind of like 3 TVs. And then I got onto this trawler and it was built in 1969, and you could really tell it was sort of this creaking, rusting old thing. And I jumped on board, and each time, you know, you've never met the other fishermen before that you're about to share a room with for a whole week. And that's when I got quite nervous. And then it's as you're going off to sea, I asked what the Wi-Fi code was, and I've never been so ashamed of myself, because he looked at me like an absolute idiot and said, what do you mean the Wi-Fi code? We don't have a Wi-Fi code. So I was suddenly like, oh God, I'm actually not going to be able to contact anyone for a week. And I didn't tell my parents that I wouldn't be able to contact them for a week. And I think so that was that kind of moment of, oh God, it's too late, and that kind of aching feeling of not wanting to leave the land. But you get into a rhythm, and after a while, you almost forget there's another world, because it's such a all-encompassing experience, because it, you know, the smells and the sounds, and every 4 hours you're gutting fish on the open deck and then waiting for the next haul and then having these massive meals together. So it very quickly became like my whole life. And wasn't without its times as well, where it felt very emotional and very difficult. I've struggled in the past with sort of depressive tendencies and not being able to do my usual kind of ways of recovering for myself. Suddenly, I just felt the boat would sometimes become so claustrophobic considering it was in the middle of the ocean. So it was a really hard experience and amazing, but difficult.
What about things like seasickness? I've seen in your writing, you've equated that with homesickness in some ways.
Yeah, so I knew that seasickness would happen because it happened the first time I'd been out on a trawler as well. But you kind of dread it and hope that somehow you'll manage to escape it. But the sort of telltale sign is when you start yawning. And I was chopping carrots with one of the guys on deck, and so not on deck, in the cabin. And he looked at me and he was like, well, there we go. You're going to be sick soon because... Yeah, I think I suddenly went really pale and then threw up for about a couple of hours, I think. And then after that, I was completely fine. So I got over it, which felt a real relief. But the reason I equate it with homesickness is this same fisherman told me an incredible story about that his brother had never got seasick before. And the two of them, they'd had sort of the older men on boats, would always be throwing up, and they just didn't feel anything at all. And as soon as his son had a child, he started becoming seasick every time he went out to sea. And so it kind of made me think and that there was almost sort of like a psychological aspect to it, whereas the more ties you get to the land, the more likely you are to become seasick because there's more that kind of holds you there. And so it's almost like a reaction against the sea of kind of not wanting to be in that environment. And there's nothing to prove that, but I just kind of thought that was quite amazing. And I thought I was only sick quite briefly, and I wondered if it was because there wasn't that much time each to the land either.
I wonder about different ways of communicating on board. Obviously, as you say, it's a different world. It was presumably an all-male environment apart from you. But away from the kind of technical language, is there more time to, I don't know, to sink into silence?
Absolutely. I think and I don't know if this is a kind of young person trait, but I was 22 when I went on the boat, and I think I'm uncomfortable. Maybe I'm more comfortable now, but I was very uncomfortable with silences and felt kind of worried about, oh God, what does it mean if I'm just sitting looking at the sea for hours with these guys? I should be saying something, I should be learning things from them. But then, yeah, you kind of let those silences draw out. And what was so lovely, so when you're on watch, you really are, you're just sitting, and it can be, so there must be someone on watch at all times of the day and the night. So sometimes I just sit late into the evenings and you just sort of be watching out the windows and it would all be black, but now and then you'd see the lights of a different boat or a cargo ship in the distance. And conversation is just kind of lovely because it's sort of untethered. So there might be silence for a while, and then suddenly you'll get into an incredibly emotional conversation about family or about love. And then again, you'll be talking about the tides and then fish and then back to the kind of this beautiful conversation. So I did find that it was just having this incredible sort of spooling time in which to speak meant that you build up these kind of amazing relationships. And I think I felt this real sense of loss when we came back to the shore and we got our phones all started working again, and suddenly we returned to our normal lives and the things that had mattered before we'd been out together at sea. And you just lose that communion so quickly.
You talk about that process, about channeling, getting ready to come back to meet families and friends.
Yeah, that you could actually feel the shift in behaviour in the boat. Suddenly everyone was singing and whistling. And I think it's because you're, in some ways, it's almost like a kind of meditative act of holding the land from your thoughts, because otherwise it would maybe overwhelm you. So suddenly on the last day, everyone's like, here we go. And we'd made a lot of money. They'd actually made a boat record that week. And I think everyone kind of knew that we'd had a lot of expensive fish that we'd got. So it was this really sort of jubilant feeling. And then that last night, no one really sleeps. You know, that's channeling, and you're kind of just imagining being at home again. And there's that bit when suddenly the land returns. And I asked Don, who is the skipper, if it gets old, that sort of sense of suddenly seeing the land again. He was like, not a bit. You see St. Michael's Mount, because New Lynn is in the Bay of St. Michael's Mount. And you just say, I'm home. And it's this sense of relief each time that you can let go again and kind of be back on dry land.
I imagine that many of the people on the boat couldn't be further from who you are. Male Brexit voting, because it's Cornwall and they did. Was that difficult at all?
I don't know. I think, again, I wasn't thinking about it very much. Definitely we did have conversations sometimes with other fishermen who'd be like, yeah, you know, if you don't want to vote for Brexit after you've been on our boat, then we'll make you walk the plank. And I'd kind of like, haha. But I think they tended to be okay with me having a different perspective. I don't think I came at them, as I don't tend to with any kind of political conversation, too hard of being like, you're completely wrong. Because actually what was really valuable for a Londoner was thinking about Brexit in terms of specific need. So, you know, they vote on fishing. I vote on, I guess, like thinking more widely about the economy and thinking about what links with Europe have meant historically. And it meant something to be like, okay, I understand you vote as a community and you vote because the Brexit Party and the Conservatives were the only people that actually came down to your town and made you these false promises, but about getting your waters back. So I kind of had that understanding. So I think in some ways we definitely were really different. And there was this kind of great moment when Kyle, one of the fishermen, we were talking about, he was the same age as me. So we had these moments of alignment where we were talking about the first places we all got drunk and threw up. And then suddenly he'd say something and I'd realize, oh yeah, no, we're really different in other ways. And you're much more grown up than me because you've had a job since you were 17 and I've been doing these kind of degrees. But I mentioned something about being posh. And he was like, oh, phew, you know you're posh. I thought I was going to have to tell you. I was like, yeah, no, I'm really aware. You can't escape this accent. But kind of in some ways it felt like a real privilege to get to spend time with people who were totally different from me. And yet we had the same kind of stupid sense of humours and were doing pranks on the boat. And yeah, I felt really lucky to get to be with them for that period of time.
Lomona, this book has had the most extraordinary reception. People are hailing you as this bright new voice in British nonfiction. And of course, you've been shortlisted for the Wainwright Prize. Tell us about that.
Oh, that's been so exciting. So I think when I first started writing, when I knew that it was going to be a book, so I'd got my publisher had okayed it and then had this kind of terrifying vacant time of being like, oh my god, how do I actually write a book? And I decided, okay, you've got to get a better grounding in what nature writing means, because I don't think I really knew, or nature travel writing memoir. So I started reading and I went to the Wainwright Prize. So I started reading people like Amy Liptrop or Adam Nicholson, all these people, these kind of like eminent figures of that genre, and obviously Robert McFarlane as well, who I think has won a couple of times now. And so that was where I went, oh my goodness, you can write in this style that is both kind of deeply thinking about the natural world, but also conversational, and also brings in literature. And wow, what an amazing melting point of a pot of writing. And I think you can see that in the prize this year as well, that it's a real range of authors, and the fact that there's two parts of the prize as well, kind of the conservation side of it too. So I think for me, it was a kind of mark of what I wanted my writing to be. So to get to be on the shortlist is just, it's just incredible.
Mm. The Nature Writing Prize, we should say, is awarded annually to the book which most successfully inspires readers to explore the outdoors and to nurture a respect for the natural world. And I'm guessing that your book will draw a lot of people to the sea.
Again, it's so strange thinking about this. So there's an incredible book by Barry Lopez called Arctic Dreams, and he talked about the fact that his book, I mean, it's so incredibly famous, and it's the years he spent trying to understand the Arctic. But then he wrote in this article that he went back and saw all these tourists sort of doing Arctic trips, and the tour guide came and shook his hand and said, thank you, this is all down to you. And he felt this incredible sense of, oh, you know, responsibility of, but there's also got to be ethical tourism, and kind of that sense of when you're writing, you're also thinking, how is this going to impact a community? And I know at the moment that in Cornwall, everyone is quite frightened about the huge waves of tourists coming at the moment in terms of thinking about the pandemic. So I had this slight sense whilst I was writing saying, is this okay that you're opening up a place to maybe get more tourists from it? Even though I know that Cornwall has a complicated relationship because it both requires tourism like most places, and yet also sometimes it can be a bit of a strain on the local community. But I think at the same time, it felt really nice to show a different kind of Cornwall, to show the working Cornwall, and also to talk about the impact of tourism, that the town next door used to be a fishing community, like Newlyn, it's called Mousel, and now it's just holiday home. So hopefully there's enough in there that kind of suggests that when you go to a place, you have to be mindful at the same time of maybe what impact you'd be having on that place too.
Lomona, thanks so much for talking to us. Dark, Salt, Clear, Life in a Cornish Fishing Town is published by Bloomsbury. It's out now. And the winner's announcement of the Wainwright Prize for Nature Writing will be made on the 9th of September. So very, very good luck to you, Lomona.
Thank you so much. And thank you for speaking to me. It's been lovely.
You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hall and Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.